we're going to turn to Daniel chapter 2. And I'm going to read this evening from verse 25 down to the end. Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? And Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days, your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed with ease. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendour was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver and gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand, and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom, inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face prostrate before Daniel and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings and the revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Also Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. Okay, so I'm guessing that we're all extremely familiar with this passage, and that that most likely I'm not going to tell anybody anything that they don't already know this evening. In fact, some of us have known this since we were at Sunday school, haven't we? Some of us have known this passage. But nevertheless, it's actually an encouraging passage when you think of what this is actually telling us. So, just a brief recap. You know that King Nebuchadnezzar had this dream in which, well, we just read what his dream was. But when he woke up in the morning, he knew what he dreamt, but he obviously didn't know what it meant. He just had this strong sense that this was something of immense significance, something that he should know. So he'd ask for his wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers, all those people who were in his pay, who were supposed to be able to decipher these things. He called them, but none of them could interpret, could tell him what the dream was, and therefore they couldn't give him the interpretation either. So Nebuchadnezzar had ordered that they should all be put to death. He thought they were ripping him off, basically. He thought they were a bunch of con men and that they should die. So he's issued the edict, and they started to put to death these wise men and magicians and astrologers. And as we said the other week, Daniel was under the same sentence, because although he wasn't an astrologer or a magician or a soothsayer or anything like that, he was numbered with the wise men of Babylon. So the sentence was upon him. But as we saw last week, because last week we were thinking particularly about what Daniel and his friends did in view of this terrible situation that they're in. There's a death penalty hanging over their head. What they did was, they didn't panic, they didn't do a runner, they didn't escape or anything like that. They went to God in prayer. They took the matter. Daniel went to his house to pray, and he called for his believing friends who were like-minded that they might pray with him. And as they prayed, God revealed to Daniel both the dream and its interpretation. So Daniel saw by revelation of God exactly what Nebuchadnezzar had seen, only to him it was given the interpretation as well. And so in verse 20 to 23, it tells us what Daniel prayed when the revelation had been given to him. Now, last week I finished off with a little question. Something for you to think about this week, and I don't know whether anybody has done or whether you forgot about it. To be honest with you, the only reason I finished off with that as a question is because I ran out of time to discuss the matter. And the question really was this: does the idea, because it says in Daniel's prayer in verse 21, well, from verse 20, Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings." So, Daniel says, it's God who raises up, who removes kings and raises up kings. God. And what I asked you to think about, I don't know whether anybody has, is does that give us any problems? The idea that God removes kings and God raises up kings. Does that give us any problems, I wonder? I mean, what I'm getting at is, obviously, if you have a good king, or a good government, or a godly king, you know, somebody like Josiah becomes King of England, or something like that, you know, I guess, none of us would have any problem with the idea that God's raised him up. But what I'm saying is what if there's a bad king? What if there's a bad government? What if there's a terrible government? What if it's an anti-God, anti-Christian regime that's in power? Does it give us any problems, the idea that God raised that up?
No. When you think of the alternative.
Well, exactly, Paul and Marie. You know, he uses it for his purposes. That's true. And as Paul says, when you think of the alternatives, because in our Bible study last week, I presented to you what some of the alternatives are to the belief that God is sovereign and in control of everything, that he changes the times and the seasons to suit his plan, and according to his wisdom and power, he raises up the kings, he puts them down, whoever they are, and it's all to bring everything ultimately to his perfect conclusions, the plan that he's predetermined from ages past. But if you don't accept that, then necessarily you've got to fall back on some of those alternatives that I suggested to you last week, and I suggested three to you, and these are things that are widely believed by a lot of people. Some people think that everything that happens, well, it happens because of fate. It's all written in the stars. Nothing you can do about it. Fate. It's the way it is, you know. And that's it. And as I said last week, that's why some people believe in astrology, because astrology tells you what's going to happen. You can't change it, but what you can do is kind of prepare for it. If it's bad news, stay indoors. You know, if it's if it's, as I said last week, you know, and you're looking for husband, and, you know, they ask this, the star says, a tall, dark stranger coming your way today, you get out there and you try and spot him. You know what I mean? In other words, you take advantage of it. But it's fate. There's nothing you can do about it. That's what some people believe. Rubbish, isn't it? Rubbish. Another idea that some people have is just everything's accidental. Everything's happened chance. We're all here by accident, and everything's happened chance. You know, there's nothing, there's no God kind of presiding over everything. There's no master plan. It's just all chance. You take your opportunities as they come along, but that's it. You know, and some people make good of it, and some people never take the chances when they come along, and some people are born into hard luck to begin with, and that's it. But life is happened chance. Third alternative, some people believe, is that everything's in life is the result of some kind of cosmic game that the gods are playing, or some kind of higher beings are playing. You know, and that's Greek mythology, basically, that Mount Olympus, you know, Zeus and his mates, they kind of look down and they're playing with man, and they're playing with kingdoms and empires. It's such a big kind of cosmic game. Some people think the space aliens. They're kind of watching over us and, you know, shifting events on Earth. There was a program used to come on telly, and basically it was that all the events of history kind of were manufactured basically by some kind of alien nation that it was amongst us. Like, you know, and we laugh, but actually people seriously believe that. Well, all of that's nonsense, isn't it? I believe that God's in control of it all. You know, whether we understand it at this point in time or not. Why, what's his name, is ruling over North Korea, you know, he's not what the Christians would want there, and he's not what most people in the world would want there, but he's there. And I cannot say that, you know, he's there by happen chance, or anything like that, difficult though it is, a concept to understand. And God is sovereign, as Daniel says, he's in control of everything. And I think that's proved by what we read next concerning this dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had and its interpretation. And so God reveals to Daniel after prayer both the dream and its interpretation. And God did this, Daniel says here in verse 30, for two main reasons. He revealed it to Daniel for two main reasons. It wasn't revealed to Daniel, Daniel himself says, it wasn't revealed to him because he had more wisdom, more natural wisdom than anybody else in the world, as we saw last week. But this kind of knowledge that Daniel receives here cannot come through studying books or through observation, through tests in the laboratory or whatever else people learn by. You can't get this kind of knowledge that way. The hidden wisdom of God only comes to people by a direct revelation of the Holy Spirit. So it's given to him, not because he's clever than everybody else, he might well have been, but that's not how he came by this information. The hidden wisdom of God only comes by a revelation of the Holy Spirit. That's what 1 Corinthians 2 is about. And according to Daniel in verse 30, this secret was revealed to him for two chief reasons. The first was, according to Daniel, for the sake of God's people. In other words, for their benefit, who were revealing this thing to the king. It was for their sake, it was to help them, it was to save them in their circumstances. And the second reason he gives was so that the king might know what his dream meant. Now, I've called this series of Bible studies Living in Babylon because, as I keep saying, spiritually speaking, as far as I'm concerned, we're living in Babylon. We're living in a kind of modern day Babylon. And that's why, you see, this book of Daniel, not all the word of God, but in this context, this book of Daniel is so relevant to us as believers today. And the point is this, you see, God has given us this revelation for the same two reasons that he gave that revelation to Daniel back then. It's for our sakes that he's given us this revelation. It's for the sake of God's people. It's for our benefit. It's to help us, you see, in the situation that we find ourselves in today. That's why he's given it us. And secondly, so that we might have understanding of our times to know what to do. But it also, the book of Daniel, the whole of the word of God, it gives us insights, you see, into the various powers that are at work in the world today. It really does. You know, you can look at you know, the things that are happening in the world, and you could say, well, why the rise of Islam in our days? You know, why is communism, you know, communist Soviet Russia, the ideals of Soviet Russia rising to the surface again? Why is the capitalist West like it? You know, you can ask all these questions. The Word of God, you know, gives you insights into why things are as they are in the world today. It helps us to understand what is behind the various power bases in the world today, and the political structures and the ideologies that are in the world. It helps us to understand there is more to these things than simply the ideas of men. There's more to it than that. And the Bible gives us spiritual insight into what is behind these things, as well as like the moral trends that are prevalent in our society today. It helps us to see all these things with spiritual eyes. It gives us insight into all these things. And it gives us, the Word of God, I think, spiritual eyes so that we can understand life in a completely different way than everyone else can. And it's also given so that we, the people of God, don't despair. Because you could, couldn't you? Looking at what's happening in the world today, you just despair a bit. But this, you see, reminds us of what the ultimate end is going to be. We've read the final chapter, haven't we?
Yeah.
And we know what the ultimate end is going to be. Nothing is going to stop God's perfect plan from coming to fruition. Nothing. Yeah. A king like Nebuchadnezzar was a totalitarian ruler that held sway over everything that was within his boundaries. The most powerful man in the world in his time. But he can't stop the plans of God. And I love what Daniel says here. You know, when he says, you are that head of gold, he says, oh, by the way, King Nebuchadnezzar, God put you where you are. And everything that is in your realm, God has given it into your care. And you've got to admire his courage. He's talking to the most powerful man in the world who thinks he's a self-made man. You know, go to chapter 4. He surveys Babylon and he's proud and he's like, he's built all this. And Daniel says, just a minute, actually God has put you where you are. You've got to admire his courage for saying that to him. And so this is what it's for. And that's why it's good for us to study the Word of God and to study books like Daniel. Okay, so let's think about the dream then and its interpretation. Okay, the dream first. Let's just read a few verses again. Verses 28 and 29. There is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. Verse 31. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that there was no trace of them found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And so first of all then, Daniel gives, before he tells the king what he dreamt, he gives him a little hint as to what the dream is all about. There in verse 29, thoughts came to your mind about what would come to pass after this. In other words, the dream you have, Nebuchadnezzar, concerns what will happen in the future, after this. You know, in other words, from now, from this point in time, it's telling you what is going to be in the future. And some of it concerns the distant future. In verse 28, what will happen in the latter days? So some of it is about the distant future, as far as Nebuchadnezzar is concerned. Bear in mind the date here that this is, Daniel is interpreting this dream to the king is sort of circa 602, 603 BC. It's just past the 6th century BC. It's a long time ago, 2,500 years ago plus. Okay, so some of it is about the distant future. So Daniel describes the king's dream to him. And this is what King Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream. He saw this great image this huge statue whose splendour, it says, was excellent. I think the NIV verse says it was dazzling and awesome in appearance. I meant to get some photographs to give out of this, but I had a look on the internet. I googled, show me the biggest statues in the world. And there's one website, and it has the top 10 biggest statues in the world. And about five of them are Buddhas in different places. And in fact, the number one isn't quite finished yet, but there's an artist's impression of it. It's in India. And it's about 500 foot high, the statue of this man. Okay. But there's these Buddhas, and they're over 300 foot high, like gold Buddhas, huge things like. And they're hideous, in my opinion. I can't stand the sight of them. But you can see in these photographs the size of people in relation to these huge Buddhas. And you've got to say that if you stood there looking at them, hideous though they are awesome. You know, when you think of the size of them, you see. As I say, I meant to run them off and show you. Maybe I'll bring one next week and show you. But that's what this was like, you see. It was this huge statue that he saw. Doesn't give the dimensions of it. Perhaps chapter 3 gives us an insight into that. But it was absolutely massive, and it was awesome. So it's this huge statue, and it's made up of different metals. The head was pure gold. The chest and arms were made of silver. The belly and thighs were made of bronze, or brass if you have an authorised version. And the legs were made of iron, the two legs were made of iron, and the feet and toes were made partly of iron and partly of potter's clay, that is baked clay. Okay? And so that's what the king saw. And in his dream, the king stood before this awesome statue, and it was awesome. He was awestruck by what he was looking at. And as he looked at this statue, he saw a stone being cut out without hands, which then came down and struck this statue in its feet. And when it struck the statue in its feet, it broke it into pieces. And the iron and the clay and the bronze and the silver and the gold, it all came tumbling down, and it was all crushed together, and it became like chaff, that is worthless dust, that the wind blew away, and there was no trace of any of it left. And that stone that struck it then became a mountain that filled the whole earth. So that was the dream. That's what Nebuchadnezzar had seen, and that's what Daniel told him. And the king, verse 47, accepted it as exactly what he dreamed. Daniel got it bang on right. That was it in all its details. So now for the interpretation. And what we're going to have to do with this is we're going to have to do it in two halves, because it's too much, this, to deal with in one go. So what we're going to do is, this evening, we're going to look at the head, the chest and arms, the belly and thighs of bronze and the legs of iron, and we're going to leave the feet and toes of iron and clay and what they mean till next week, okay? The interesting thing about this passage, if you look at it, is there's far more attention paid to the feet and toes and what happens at that point than all the other bits of it put together. There's far more attention placed on that than everything else. So what we'll do is we'll look at that next week, and this week, in the main, we'll look at the first parts of it. So, here's the interpretation then, as Daniel gives it. The statue which the king saw in his dream, it represents a series of kingdoms, or empires, that would arise. Beginning with the Babylonian Empire of Nebuchadnezzar, that obviously was already in existence at this particular point in time. Verse 37 and 38, you, O king, are a king of kings, you are that head of gold. So it begins with the kingdom of Babylon, that is the head of gold. But after you, Daniel says, shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, and that's represented by the chest and arms of silver. And again, if you think about this, you've got to admire Daniel's courage here, because this is a king who's so puffed up and proud in his own heart, he thinks he's going to last forever, and his kingdom is going to last forever. And Daniel's saying, after you, another kingdom will arise, and actually it'll be inferior to yours, but it will arise. And that's represented by the chest and arms of silver. And then he says, and then another kingdom, that is represented by the belly and thighs of bronze, and then a fourth that is as strong as iron, verses 39 to 40. And then he goes on to talk about the feet and toes of iron and clay in verses 41 to 43, which represent, we'll just say at this point, a kind of the final form or the final phase of that empire that's represented by the legs of iron. It's not a different empire, it's not another one. You know, the first empire is the head of gold, the second empire is the chest of silver, the third empire is the belly of bronze, the fourth empire is the legs of iron, but the feet and toes are not a fifth, they are just, as it were, the final form of that fourth empire. Are you with me? That's what is represented by that. And then Daniel says in verses 44 and 45, in the days of these kings, so he's talking about the kings who reign during the period represented by the feet and toes. In the days of these kings, God will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. This kingdom, in other words, will not be superseded or taken over by another, as was the case in the first four. Babylon was taken over by whatever is represented by silver. That was taken over by what is represented by bronze. That was taken over by what was represented by iron. But this kingdom that God sets up will not be superseded. It won't be taken up by any other. And in fact, the kingdom represented here, that God sets up, is represented by this stone which hits the feet of this statue that breaks it in pieces. In other words, it will break into pieces all the kingdoms that came before it. It will break into pieces and there'll be no trace of them anymore. Just like the chaff blew it all away into the wind and there was nothing left of it. That which God sets up, his kingdom, will break into pieces everything that went before, and his kingdom will fill the whole earth like the stone became a mountain, you see. So that's the meaning of the king's dream. And what it is, in effect, is world history foretold, beginning with Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. This great statue which Nebuchadnezzar saw represents a succession of four kingdoms and empires followed by a fifth. That is the one represented by this stone, God's kingdom. So, do we know then what these kingdoms were that are represented? Alan does, he's nodding his head. But these kingdoms that are represented by the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, do we know what they were? Because, of course, when you look at this, apart from the first of these kingdoms, the one represented by the head of gold, which Daniel himself identifies as the Babylonian Empire of Nebuchadnezzar, you, O king, are the head of gold, you know, apart from that one, the other kingdoms are not identified, at least they're not here. Actually, two of them are in chapter 8. They're named. The fourth isn't named at all anywhere in the book of Daniel. So, do we know what they were? Actually, if you turn to the seventh chapter of Daniel, we're not really studying this tonight, we'll study this in more depth when we get to it. But in the seventh chapter of Daniel, we read of a vision that Daniel had much later on in his life. And in this vision, he saw four great beasts arising up out of the sea. And so we'll just read, just out of interest, we'll just read the first 10 verses. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, a second like a bird, it was raised up on one side, and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and beheld a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring and breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had ten horns. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came from before him. Thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and books were opened. We'll leave it at that. And so, Daniel, later in life, has this vision, and he sees four beasts rising up out of the sea. And it's the sea of humanity, you see. And obviously, we'll look at this passage in more detail when we get to it. But you see, it turns out that the meaning of Daniel's vision in chapter 7 of these beasts, which was explained to him later in the chapter by an angel, was effectively the same as chapter 2. It's saying the same thing. The four beasts in Daniel's vision represent four kingdoms or four empires that would arise, and they are actually the same four kingdoms, the same four empires that are represented by the different metals on Nebuchadnezzar's statue, you see, that he sees in his dream. Only in chapter 7 there are actually more details given through the symbolism contained in the imagery of these various beasts and things associated with them. When we understand the symbolism of it, when we understand what that imagery represents, there is more detail given, you see, about these various kingdoms and empires. But the point is, because of the order of succession in which these kingdoms come, both in the statue that Nebuchadnezzar sees, the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, and in the beasts that Daniel sees in chapter 7, because of the order in which they come, and because of the symbolical significance of the different metals in Nebuchadnezzar's vision, and the symbolism on the beasts that Daniel sees, and because of the position we are now in, where we can now look back across history and we know what has taken place, we are in a position to know exactly what these kingdoms are. And so I've got these little diagrams for you. In fact, I've got 10. How many is here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. 12. So maybe you could give them out for us, Ken, but there's only 10, so maybe couples can share. Maybe couples can share, I don't know, but maybe you don't all want one. But it's a picture, it's an artist's impression of what Nebuchadnezzar has seen, in his vision, and it obviously depicts the different metals. And to the left, it says world history foretold, and it tells you what the different kingdoms are that were represented by these different metals. So the head of gold in chapter 2 and the lion with eagle's wings in chapter 7 represent the kingdom of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom of Babylon. That began 605, he became king in 605 BC, and that went through to 539 BC, at which point in time Babylon fell to the kingdom of the Medes and Persians. Later it became the Persian Empire, but initially it was a combination of two nations, the Medes and Persians, and Babylon fell to the Medes and Persians in 539 BC. And the kingdom of Medes and Persians is represented on Nebuchadnezzar's statue by the chest and arms of silver, and in chapter 7 by this burr, this image of this animal, this burr with bones in its mouth and things. And actually King Cyrus was at the point in time when Babylon fell to the Medes and Persians. King Cyrus was the overall emperor, and he, you might recall, is mentioned. He's mentioned in Isaiah. Actually, Isaiah prophesied about Cyrus 170, 200 years before Cyrus was even born. But recently, we've been doing those Bible studies in Chronicles, and at the end of 2 Chronicles 36, verse 22, it says, "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put it into writing." He was the emperor of the kingdom of the Medes and Persians when Babylon fell to them. And another man called Darius was a kind of co-regent. Cyrus was the overall emperor. Darius was a co-regent. So if you go to chapter 5 of the book of Daniel, it's at the end of the chapter, well, chapter 5 is really about the fall of Babylon to the Medes and Persians, but verse 30 of chapter 5, "That very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom, and over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one." So that Darius was a kind of initially a co-regent with Cyrus, you see. And that was the kingdom of the Medes and Persians, represented by the chest and arms of silver. And according to the diagram you've got there, that kingdom of Persia lasted from about 539 BC through to 331 BC, when it fell to Alexander the Great, who you've all heard about. If you've seen the film, it's Richard Burton, I think, if my memory serves me right. But well, there we are. Alexander the Great, a very young man, when he basically conquered the world in a very short space of time. I think about 11 years or something. It took him to conquer everywhere from North Africa to India. And he died in his early 30s, Alexander the Great did. And he was the founder and first emperor of the Greek Empire, the kingdom of Greece. And he's represented on this statue by the belly and thighs of bronze. Or in chapter 7, he's represented by this leopard beast that had four wings on its back. Again, I meant to bring this picture, but I forgot. But I'll bring it when perhaps we get to chapter 7. But there's a famous picture of Alexander the Great riding his horse with speed, because it was the speed of the Greeks that smashed everything before them that was just incredible. And there's this famous picture with Alexander the Great, and he's riding his horse, and he's got this leopard skin. I don't know if it's a leopard skin tunic or a leopard skin over his horse. Quite significant, because here he's described as a leopard, you see, and it's got four wings on its back. And the significance of that, of course, is that when Alexander died, and you see, he was only in his early 30s when he died, but his vast empire then was divided up between four of his generals. And so it was split up between four of his generals, represented by the four wings on the back of this leopard, you see. And again, the leopard is a tremendously significant piece of imagery to use of Alexander, because, I'll say, of the speed with which he conquered. You know, but as I say, after his death, it's split between four of his generals. And in fact, part of chapter 8 describes the speed and ferocity with which he attacked the Persian Empire, and it fell to him. And then in chapter 11 is an incredible chapter of the Bible, because it details, it gives details in enormous minutiae of detail, all the history of the period following Alexander right through to the end of the Greek Empire. And it goes through king after king after king, and the details are so incredible that liberal Bible scholars refuse to accept that Daniel could have been written by Daniel in the 6th century BC. because the details are so accurate and so detailed. They say it had to be written after the event, okay? Because chapter 11 is just so incredibly detailed, and the most details it gives, as I say, Alexander's kingdom was split between four of his generals, but it particularly details two of them, who chapter 11 calls the king of the north and the king of the south. And historians know them as the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. The Ptolemies ruled over Egypt, that sort of North Africa area, and the Seleucids ruled over what will be like Syria, and they were constantly battling over what is the land of Israel, you see, and to rule over the Jews. So chapter 11 gives incredible detail. Eventually, though, the Greek Empire was superseded by the Roman Empire, into which it was absorbed, really. And the date that's given on your little diagram there is 168 BC, is when Rome is officially recognised to have become an empire. And the Roman Empire is depicted in chapter 2 by the legs of iron, and in chapter 7 by this terrible beast with iron teeth that devoured and broke in pieces everything in its path and trampled the residue with its feet. And I tell you, a better and more concise description of the Roman machine I have never read anywhere in all my life than that simple statement that it was like a terrible beast with iron teeth that devoured and broke into pieces everything in its path and trampled everything under it. That was the Roman machine. And the statue, of course, as you can see, has two legs. It's a statue of a man. It has two legs. And that depicts the fact, you see, that eventually the Roman Empire came to be divided into two parts, east and west. The eastern part of the Roman Empire had Constantinople as its capital, which today is Istanbul, and the western part, the western part of the empire has its capital in Rome. The eastern part of the empire had its capital in Constantinople, which today is Istanbul, which is of course in Turkey. And out of the eastern part of the empire came the Byzantine Empire, and out of the western part eventually came the Holy Roman Empire, you see. So that's the two legs of iron. How incredibly detailed this is when you start to look at your history book, and you look at this, it's just a statue. But God has got everything, obviously, right on. So then there's four kingdoms, and they are represented in these visions, both in chapter 2 and in chapter 7. And I say, as far as I'm concerned, this is amazing, because Daniel was talking here to King Nebuchadnezzar in circa 603 BC. All right? And I say that's amazing for this reason. See, you might say it was fairly natural and an easy thing for Daniel to say to King Nebuchadnezzar, "You are that head of gold." I mean, it might have been politically expedient to say that to the king, you know. But I would suggest to you that he might have had another reason for saying that to him as well. That head of gold, its face might have been a dead ringer for King Nebuchadnezzar. It might have actually looked like him. So he said, "You are that head of gold." So that's easy for him, isn't it? And if Daniel was an astute observer of world events and a good political analyst, he might even have been able to guess that the next big world power might be the Medes and Persians, because for a time now they have been rising up. He might have been able to think, well, if something's going to take over from Babylon, it may well be the Persians, you know. So that might have been a good guess. But as for Greece and Rome, in the 6th century BC, they were little more than city-states. See? You would no more imagine, in the 6th century BC, Rome becoming the world power that it became, than you could imagine America today being the world power it is today in 1620, when the Pilgrim Fathers landed on the east coast of America and set the first colony up there. If you'd have said that would become the number one world power in the world. People would have laughed. In fact, the British would definitely have laughed, because they would say, that is ours. But within 100 years or so, whenever it was, there was a war of independence and Britain lost it. And now it is the superpower of the world. But in 1620 and the decades following that, you'd have laughed at anybody who'd say that had become a world power. Well, so it was with Rome and Greece at the time that Daniel is speaking here. To imagine Rome in Daniel's time becoming what it became would be laughable. And again, that's why liberal scholars do not accept the book of Daniel could possibly have been written by Daniel in the 6th century BC. And it must have been written probably 2nd century BC, after the events certainly described in most of chapter 11. But of course they've still got a problem, even with that. And the problem they've got is Rome. Because even if you put the book of Daniel, and I'm not doing, but even if you put it in the 2nd century BC, you've still got to account for Rome, which didn't become an empire really until at least 168 BC, and running after that, and the division, the two legs, didn't come till several centuries AD. So they've still got a problem with that. But is it a problem for you? It's not a problem for me. Why not? Because I believe what Daniel says in chapter 2, verse 21. God changes times and seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. So if you believe God's sovereign, then it's not a problem to you, is it? God could have revealed this to Adam in the garden if he chose to. You know, because he knew that far back, actually. He knew even before that. So none of this gives us any problems. Now, these are the four empires represented by the gold, silver, bronze and legs of iron. And obviously, as I said earlier, you know, we've not talked about the feet and toes of iron and clay, even though far more attention is paid to them. And it's the same actually in chapter 7. You know, when it talks about the beast with iron teeth, it goes on to talk about 10 horns on its head. And another little horn that comes up from among, and it pays far more attention to that than it does to the beast with the teeth in its mouth. You know, so we're going to look at that next week, because that describes a form of this fourth empire, which we've seen is the Roman Empire, that actually is yet to be. It is that form of the Roman Empire that will be in existence when, as it says here, Christ comes again and puts to an end all human power, all human empire is brought to nothing. I want you to notice something else about this image quickly before we finish. It's one statue, even though it represents four empires that are all different. And similarly in chapter 7. Four beasts that are diverse from each other. But in chapter 2, it's one statue. And the different metals, as they go down, gold to silver to bronze to iron, they are inferior in value. Silver is less value than gold. Bronze is less value than silver. Iron is less value, even though iron is stronger than all the others. What is precious to man, strength, is inferior in quality to God. But the thing is this, there's four empires, they're all diverse, but God sees them all as one statue. What is it? It's all, whatever nature a regime or an empire or a politic takes, be it capitalism or communism, democracy or totalitarian rule, you know, religious zealot or atheistic, whatever, they're all diverse. And they fight one another. Just like these empires fought one another. But you know, God sees them all as one. It's all rebellion against God. That's what it is. So take a choice. You pay your money, you take your choice. Do I like democracy or do I like totalitarian rule? Most people prefer democracy. But without God, it's still rebellion. That's what it is. Last thing before we close. It says at the top of your diagram on the left, world history foretold. So what this whole period that's covered by these four empires covers is world history from the time of Nebuchadnezzar, apparently, till the time that Christ comes again and sets up his kingdom. And so it's world history, but it's told in connection with just four empires. Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. Four empires. So you might say to yourself, well, wait a minute, there's been more empires than that. I mean, far to the east, there was an incredible empire of the Chinese, wasn't there, Alex? Incredible. You look at some of the things, I mean, look at, Chinese Wall, Terracotta Army. I mean, these were people of immense wisdom and capability and power. And there's been many other empires too. There's been the Ottoman Empire, there's been the British Empire. The sun never went down on the British Empire. It was truly global. And then in the 20th century, you've got the Soviet Empire, massive. You have currently the Empire of America, really. It's a vast power. So the question you ask yourself is, why are only these empires mentioned? The Babylonian, the Persian, the Greek, and the Roman. Why is it not mentioned British Empire? Why is it not mentioned all these others? Well, that's something you can have a think about this week, and we'll back to that one next week. Because it is an interesting question if you think about it.
Yeah.
And the British Empire lasted a very long time. So why is it not mentioned here? You have a think about that, and we'll pick it up there next week. Amen. So let's just have some prayer then, shall we, before we...